Hello, and welcome to the Security Ledger Podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, the editor-in-chief and publisher of the Security Ledger. The credit monitoring firm Equifax released its third quarter financial results last week and put an $87 million figure on the cost of the data breach that affected 140 million individuals in the U.S., Canada, and the United Kingdom. But what's behind that $87 million figure? On this week's podcast, we speak with Kevin Richards of the firm Accenture, which has just come out with a report on the cost of cybercrime. Also, we've heard a lot about the so-called dark market, where cyber criminals ply their trade. In this week's podcast, we talk with Olivia Rowley of the firm Flashpoint about research her firm has done looking at the so-called deep and dark web, where data breaches have flooded markets with stolen data. But first, following the Security Ledger's reporting on North Korea's forays onto the networks of U.S. defense contractors, the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI issued a joint technical alert about a campaign of hacks dubbed Hidden Cobra that has been linked to the reclusive government of North Korea. For this week's podcast, we sit down with Adam Myers, the Vice President of Intelligence at the firm CrowdStrike, to talk about his company's research into the widening net of North Korea's cyber offensive operations. Myers fills us in on his company's intelligence about how the North Korean government is targeting a wide range of firms for reasons ranging from espionage to financial gain. I started out by asking Adam to tell us about recent North Korean attacks against defense contractor networks and how the North Koreans get their foot in the door.
Adam Myers, and my title is VP of Intelligence. Looking back a couple of weeks ago, we were tracking and started reporting on targeting of defense contractors and financials by a threat actor that we call Labyrinth Kalima, which industry folks typically track as under the name HaUp, which is the name of the remote access toolkit that they deploy. And they were using English language and Korean language decoys where they were trying to leverage job-themed kind of, you know, looking for jobs or how to interview for a job type of things, and use that to entice the would-be target to open the file, and that would deploy this remote access toolkit.
So what we're talking about here are attacks targeted at employees of these firms that maybe have business selling weapons or developing weapon systems?
It would be HR-related targeting. So it might be sending at a potential employee, sending them, you know, a job description of something that they might be interested in. We've seen some that involved how to effectively interview at certain locations. And we've seen financially themed ones as well. So it hasn't just been defense contractor.
And what's the MO here? So, okay, they've got the HR, somebody in the HR department, or they've got a prospective candidate or an employee at the company. What then?
So we've tracked North Korean actors, and there's about a handful that we track today. They have a couple of different missions that they partake in. We've seen classic espionage missions where they're trying to steal information that might be sensitive or not publicly available. We've seen them trying to prepare for destructive attacks and to conduct destructive attacks. Examples of that would be, of course, the big one was the Sony Pictures Entertainment attack back in 2014. We also saw have observed targeting by North Korean groups of various power equities within South Korea. There was a wiper attack against power company that was responsible for nuclear power in South Korea. We've seen destructive attacks against financials and media as well in South Korea. So there's been a lot of historic kind of destructive attacks, wiper attacks associated with North Korean actors. And then we've also observed financial attacks where they're trying to generate revenue. Some of these attacks could be ransomware type attacks, or we have associated code overuse between North Korean actors and the actors that perpetrated the SWIFT attacks last year. So some of their mission is to generate revenue for perhaps the regime, perhaps you know, the nuclear program, or even you know, to fund their own operations.
And are these all carried out by the same group? We hear the group, we hear the name Lazarus Group thrown around. Is this all just different operations carried out by the same group, or within North Korea, has this diversified? Are there now multiple groups doing different types of operations or maybe specializing in a certain type of operation?
From the CrowdStrike perspective, Lazarus is kind of an umbrella term. It overlaps with three of the various groups that we track associated with North Korea. All of the North Korean groups that we track under the name Chilima. And Chilima is an animal that's associated with North Korea pretty closely, and it's a magic flying horse, which was what we were looking for when we were trying to come up with a name for the adversary. We use kind of this digraph or cryptonym for how we track adversaries. So Panda is China, and Russia is Bear. And so North Korea for us is Chilima. And so there's three different of these Chilima actors that we associate with the activity that has been described in industry reporting as Lazarus.
And how, I mean, you guys track, as you said, advanced persistent threat groups across many different countries, Iran, Russia, China. How different is the MO, the modus operandi of the North Korean hacking groups from, say, a Chinese advanced persistent threat group?
So we like to call it TTPs, tactics, techniques, procedures. And the overall, on the motive and how they kind of conduct some of these attacks, they tend to be fairly consistent, right? You break in, you escalate privileges, you move laterally across the infrastructure, find the information that you're looking for, and exfiltrate it out. For espionage operations, in destructive attacks, they effectively run the same playbook, but when they spread laterally, the goal is not to find information and exfiltrate it. It's to deploy tools that can be used to remotely wipe or destroy systems. The financial motivated one is something that is very unique to North Korea. We haven't seen any other actors, Russia, China, etc., really getting involved in revenue generation. They're primarily focused on espionage and in some cases destructive attacks. And with North Korea, that one is definitely unique. In terms of the tools that they use, they build a lot of their own tools, and that's kind of how we kind of attribute them or start to kind of classify them into these categories that we associate with North Korea. In some cases, it's very similar to Russia, China, and other nation states. In some cases, or in some aspects of it, it has unique elements that are, you know, really a hallmark of North Korean activity.
And when we're talking about them being engaged in revenue generation, what types of things are we talking about?
We've seen them involved in using botnets to create fraudulent, you know, advertising type traffic. We've seen them involved in ransomware attacks, and then with the current Swift attacks. And also, there seems to be indication that they may be targeting Bitcoin-specific businesses, because if you steal a Bitcoin wallet, that's effectively like stealing cash. And it gives them kind of, one, the ability to get access to that information, get access to that currency very, very cleanly. And two, Bitcoin can be used to subvert the sanctions. So they can spend Bitcoin freely in other places and not really have to worry too much about various sanctions.
This really scrambles the picture. We're used to talking about cyber criminal hacking groups and then advanced persistent threat groups, generally kind of more nation state. But here you have a nation state group that's engaged in explicitly cyber criminal activity.
If you look at North Korea, though, it makes sense. You know, they have to fund a lot of their own operations from the intelligence perspective, and having, if you're involved in cyber espionage and cyber destructive attacks, then using that same capability to generate revenue, to self-fund operations, to help fund, you know, nuclear research, help fund various things that you need to fund. And there's, you know, without getting into all the details, there's a lot of great reporting out there about some of the offices within the North Korean government that have kind of specific interests in currency and gaining access to currency. So, you know, if you look at North Korea as a nation state, too, there's a lot of reporting about some of the things that they do outside of cyber that have similar kind of capabilities. There's the, you know, there's reporting that they've been involved in a lot of counterfeiting of currency. They've been involved in allegedly drug smuggling, involved in human trafficking. So there's all kinds of reporting out there on other aspects of how North Korean, the offensive capabilities have been leveraged to generate currency as well.
And with some of the other nation-state actors, I'm thinking of China in particular, firms like CrowdStrike have been able to even pinpoint, you know, here's the building in, you know, Beijing where we think this unit operates out of. Do we have anything like that degree of understanding or specificity about North Korea's cyber offensive units and capabilities, or is it still mostly shrouded in mystery?
There's a lot of things you can kind of track to the door, but it's hard to go past that door because, you know, it is not a very open society and they don't have a tremendous, you know, presence on the internet. So, you know, one of the examples that I would point to is in 2014, we released a report on a group we track as Putter Panda that was targeting satellite companies. You know, one of the things that we found was that a malware command and control domain had been registered to a physical building in Shanghai. And we identified a person that we thought was related to that domain. And what we found was that we had actually identified a building that he had posted in pictures in Shanghai. And that was the address of the building in the domain registration. And so we were able to tie all this together. And that building turned out to be the 12th Bureau of the 3rd General Staff Department. So that was a cool case, but there are not very many like that, right? Where you can actually get malware tied to a human, tied to a physical building, tied to a government entity. You know, that is an uncommon occurrence in the cyber domain. And what I would say is that when we start off investigating these things, we start off with really what I would say is categorization. Is this, there's three kind of motivations that we typically see that are e-criminals tend to have financially motivated operations. Targeted intrusion actors are typically involved in espionage, data exfiltration, and occasionally destructive attacks. Hacktivist actors tend to be focused on ideology and web defacements or DDoS attacks or potentially data destruction attacks. So, what we've seen over the last year, I think, is that there's a muddying of the water there and that there's actors that are kind of taking some of those data destruction elements and some of the criminal elements and kind of taping them together. But, you know, in general, our approach is to say, okay, is this something that's financially motivated? Or is this something that is, you know, specifically targeted to a specific, you know, more along the lines of a nation state? And so as we start to kind of categorize the various threats that we look at, we put them into those three buckets typically. And then from there, we can start to figure out, okay, who are the other targets that they're going after? Are they going after NATO and various, you know, European targets? And are these things all in line with a particular, you know, nation state? So, you know, perhaps Russia would be more aligned with that versus somebody like China, who might be more focused on the Philippines and Vietnam and the South China Sea is a lot of their targeting. So as we start to look at the kind of over time, what we're able to observe, we get a better perspective of what country of origin might this be associated with. And then we wrap all of this with estimative language so that we can kind of properly express, like, we think that this is the case, or we have a degree of confidence that this is the case. And and very rarely does it actually turn into, this is the guy that did it.
So we know that the North Korean military is interested in weapon systems, interested in U.S. and I'm guessing other countries' defense contractors, want to try and gain an edge in these systems or these weapons that may be used against them in the event of a conflict. How successful have these forays been? Do we know if they've actually obtained any sensitive information on weapon systems use on the Korean Peninsula?
You know, for many, many years, the preponderance of their targeting has been focused on South Korea. It's only, you know, really in the last, you know, couple of years where we've seen an increase on non-South Korean targeting. And, you know, I think that their goal has historically been to disrupt South Korea and try to make things difficult for South Korea. And in recent months, the targeting of defense industrial base, the targeting of financial, you know, we're not really sure what their intentions are. We haven't been able to observe enough of what they're going after within those defense contractors or in the financials to you know, understand, is this espionage or is this potentially, a destructive attack, you know, or laying the groundwork for a destructive attack. historically they've conducted both missions, and you know, with the increasing international tension, you know, we're not sure exactly what they're at right now.
What would be some telltale signs from your standpoint that, oh, this might be about setting the charges, as it were, for some destructive cyber attack that really is intended to just cripple this organization, not to extract information from it?
Historically, they kind of start off as the same thing. And so really, I think that the best guidance that we can give to organizations that are being targeted is to maintain extreme visibility. You have to understand exactly where these guys are on the infrastructure and what they've done while they were there in order to understand, you know, what it was that they were getting into. We've seen tools that they have that have keywords built into them. They're looking for things like secret and top secret and army and various Korean language equivalencies to that. So they've got a shopping list of things that they're looking for from an espionage perspective.
You know, the defense contractor we talked to made assurances of, oh, you know, our classified networks with the weapons designs are not connected at all to our corporate, you know, kind of enterprise network, which is what was being targeted. So this was a big nothing. In your experience, just thinking about CrowdStrike's own customers or companies that you've come across in that sector, is that true, or is it often possible for actors like North Korea to jump from that business network to the classified network where the, you know, really valuable stuff is stored?
I think that really depends on network to network. You know, we hear this with critical infrastructure all the time too, where you have the IT, which is the information technology network, and then what they call the OT, the operational technology network, which is where industrial control systems and things are, and they're all air gapped. We've seen various threat actors that have the ability to jump over an air gap using things like USB sticks, using other devices that get moved between the two networks, right? An air gap network, or what they used to call a sneaker net, because you would have to run between the two networks. If you're exchanging data between the two, if you're moving things back and forth, then there's always a potential for an actor to jump with the device or with the, whatever it is, going from one network to the other.
These companies that make defense systems, like car companies, have very long supply chains. Is there interest amongst the North Koreans and others in targeting those companies in the supply chain as well? And do we see evidence that that's part of their operation?
Over the last quarter or even a little bit more now, we've been tracking an increase in supply chain attacks. We've seen attacks against, they've been in the media, CCleaner, and there was one against Python, right, where they were going after the PyPI, database. We've seen NetSerang. We've seen attacks against
Medox,
Eltima, Handbrake. So there's been a whole slew of increasing vulnerabilities and exploitation of the supply chain. We have not associated any of those with North Korea, but the incidents are certainly on the increase. They have strong potential for a threat actor that wants to get access to, a hard target, to use one of these softer supply chain mechanisms to get access to that hard target.
What about human intelligence? What about the use of, putting somebody inside the company who can launch an attack from within their corporate network, do we see any evidence that the North is using that approach as well?
Well, let me come back to that. And one more thing, I'll point out that even, just this last week, there was a recently disclosed Crunchyroll incident, where Crunchyroll.com had a DNS redirect that caused executables to be downloaded.
When we hear about things like that, that sound kind of, like they're consumer focused, or maybe it's scammers who might be behind that. Should we take a second look?
It might not necessarily be. I mean, the CCleaner attack was, very widespread and had a huge list of potential targets, but the number of targets that were actually, tasked through that were very small. And so, that was a That's, I think, what you're going to see with the supply chain attack is that you're going to have a potential exposure that is massively high, but only a very small number of those that were exposed are actually deployed or tasked or have an implant delivered to them. That will be how you can discern a supply chain attack that was meant to say, you know, years ago, the good example was somebody targeted the website that was used for parking at the Super Bowl to push out, you know, e-crime malware. That was a very widespread attack. They wanted to get as many infections as they could. With something like CCleaner, they had a wide potential install base, but a very small subset that was actually actioned. That is, you know, I think how you would see a targeted intrusion by a nation state or, you know, a specific actor like that actually using a supply chain attack to get access to a smaller subset of interesting targets.
Sony Pictures Entertainment came as a huge shock to everybody, both that they were targeted, why they were targeted, you know, over this, you know, the interview, this movie that they made, and obviously the destructiveness of the attack. Where are we with North Korea? Do you feel like the good guys, your company included, have a handle on what they're up to and what they're capable of? Or is it one of these, you know, we'll find out when we find out type situations?
With the interview and Seth Rogen and whatever, you know, months and months before that attack in November of 2014, North Korea stated that releasing a movie about the assassination of their leader would be considered an act of war. So I think, you know, in retrospect, of course, now you're like, oh, okay, they meant that, right? They meant business. I think at the time everybody was like, okay, yeah, sure, it's an act of war, but it's a Seth Rogen movie. You know, I think now in terms of do we have a handle on what they're capable of, you know, I think that they continue to surprise us. They do things that are, you know, not consistent with what we would have expected a targeted intrusion actor to do. But I think across the whole space, we're seeing cyber, you know, escalations in cyberspace that we hadn't really seen for the years before, where it was kind of quiet espionage. Now we're seeing destructive attacks. We're seeing things like NotPetya. And, you know, I think it's not just North Korea. I think we're seeing an escalation in what various actors are doing in the digital realm.
Adam Meyer of the firm CrowdStrike, thank you so much for coming on board the Security Ledger.
Sure thing.
Up next, when Equifax published its third quarter financial results, the world got its first look at the financial impact of the recent data breach on the company's financials. The picture wasn't pretty. Equifax estimated a total cost of $87 million in just the third quarter and saw its year-on-year profits slip. That doesn't take into account the billions in value that disappeared when Equifax's stock slumped by more than 30% on the news. Still, the $87 million figure that Equifax cited might not tell the whole story of what the company's monumental blunder will cost. To understand more what is at stake, we sat down this week with Kevin Richards, the global lead for security strategy at the firm Accenture. His company recently teamed up with the Poneman Institute for a study on the cost of cybercrime. I started out by asking Kevin to talk about the Equifax breach and the company's $87 million figure. I want to know whether that number, while large, wasn't really a small price to pay for a company as large as Equifax.
Kevin Richards. I lead our North America security practice for Accenture, and I am also our global lead for security strategy and risk. If you look at the report that we saw from, for Equifax, you're right. The $87.5 million was clearly, that's a lot of money. But we also saw their stock price dip. We saw that their profits were down, I think it was 27% from previous year. Which has, there's a reputational component, there's a shareholder value component, or shareholder trust component that they have to think about, that reputational cost that factors into this. So I think that you're right, a small company that had to face a $80 or $100 million cost of a cyber breach, that would put them out. They would face corporate mortality. But I think that even for big companies, you know, if you get market caps in the billions, it's forcing people to take a look at, is this an organization that I want to do business with? And I think that there is the market does shop with its pocketbook. And when you've got other options, every little bit matters. And this one specifically hitting, what is it, 140 million people. That's a lot, right? That's every working adult in the U.S. all of a sudden now has to face this. But I think that there's another piece that's really interesting on this one, Paul, as we look at what this really means. I think this is going to be transformational with the way we view identity, because the things that we would hold dear, the things that I know, my social security number, I've got that, my secret questions, those are all now exposed. So whether it was this one, a range of breaches over the last couple of years, it's going to change the conversation of how we manage identity and trust. And yeah. So I think that's the other interesting thing, because it's going to be profound in the market, and it's going to be profound for companies that are going to have to change the way that they do a lot of interaction with, whether it's their customers, their shareholders, and their employees. Because the things that we held as secrets are no longer secret. We're going to have to come up with a different paradigm for that.
Are we talking in response to Equifax? You know, if everybody's social security number is already out there, then we need to think about, getting rid of our use of, or ending our use of, social security numbers as unique identifiers. Is it that, or is it more broad in that the ways that companies manage the identity of their users and customers is vulnerable?
Yeah, and I think it's a little bit of both. The latest thing here, this is just yet another. I mean, you could go back even over the last couple of years, and there's been a lot of really big breaches. This one certainly hit most consumers, but when we look back at the OPM issue for people with clearances and government workers, a few of the larger healthcare providers or insurance providers, they had some issues. We've had two of the three big credit agencies have big breaches.
Yep. IRS, the IRS and the tax identity fraud.
Right? Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, there are too many examples. So I think that this is just the latest iteration of it. I think this is going to put the spotlight, again, the microscope spotlight on this of, all right, is this unique identifier truly unique? And the answer now is it's become no. So we do need a different way of doing that. And I think there's some technological components to that. And you're probably already seeing it now. When you go to certain banking sites or retail sites, they're not trusting the login. You're getting the multi-factor or the code. Please enter your code in so that we can continue this transaction. That's a great first step. And so I think that's going to become much more pervasive. And I think what this latest breach is really kind of, again, shining that spotlight thing, we need a different way, because what we've been doing is we can't rely on that anymore.
So when we look at Equifax and their accounting, at least in their most recent quarter, of costs related to the breach, I mean, what we see is, they spent a fair amount on attorneys and remediation, hiring, I think it was Mandiant, to come in and help them understand what had happened on their network, and then kind of unnamed or unspecified, software and services related to remediation. And then there is the make good part of this, which is trying to make their customers whole again, offering free credit monitoring services. That's actually part of their business. It's a pretty standard cost for companies that have been breached. So maybe the cost to them is lower than it would be to another company. How does that line up to the types of costs that you guys see in this survey, where, to the extent the companies are paying to get whole again after these incidents? Is this the types of things they're paying for?
Yes, there are a lot of those costs, the notification and credit services and things. Those are really that cost of data breach component. This survey was more of the infrastructure around it, kind of before the data left the building, so to speak. So what we measured within our survey here were the monitoring systems, their identity management, their data loss prevention and encryption technologies and automation and things like that around the technological infrastructure and the services around these components to eradicate the badness within the infrastructure, not so much the how much do credit card services cost? That's
right.
We were more focused on the processes and the systems and the people that are in place to actually defend ourselves against the bad stuff.
So one of the things that you guys concluded was that companies are really not allocating their precious cybersecurity dollars in ways that are getting them the biggest bang for the buck in terms of risk reduction and attack prevention. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. This I think was one of the big surprises as we looked at the responses. And so one of the questions we asked was around how much are you spending on these technologies that can actually make a difference? Well, first we look at the ones that were effective, the security monitoring systems, advanced identity management. And we had a range of those that went all the way through data loss prevention software and encryption technologies, and then policy management, and then automation or orchestration that can, you know, help at machine speeds react and respond to the infrastructure, to bad things that are going on. And so what we saw was there were some areas where that were really effective in reducing cybercrime. And then we overlaid that because it was part of our question base is where are you actually spending your money? And what we found is really the biggest part of the money was being spent on the things that had the lower positive impact actually about reducing cybercrime. So for example, the biggest area of spend from a budget perspective was around perimeter controls. So your network edge point technologies. But what we saw was that as far as reducing cybercrime, that was one of the lesser effective tools to actually stop cybercrime. People are getting in through other ways. They're getting in through phishing attacks. There's other kinds of application vulnerability that the edge protections just didn't make a difference. But conversely, we saw things like security intelligence systems and automation were incredibly effective at reducing the impact of cost of cybercrime. They just weren't being, that's not where people were spending their money. So there are some big gaps between the things that are actually effective in stopping cybercrime versus what we've traditionally spent our money on. And this is in many cases that spend revolves around a lot of compliance expectations. So the auditors will say, show me your firewall rules or show me your endpoint protection and your antivirus. And they're good hygiene areas, but those aren't the things that are actually stopping the cybercrime. And so that was a big difference that we saw that was pretty dramatic in a number of areas.
So previous reports I've read have identified a couple troubling trends. One is that companies, as a percentage of overall IT spend, you know, information security is still small and probably much smaller than it should be. And the other, as your own study points out, is that a lot of that already small spend is committed to legacy technologies, whether that's desktop antivirus or firewalls, perimeter defenses that your study suggests are probably not giving you a very big bang for the buck. Are we seeing any shift in that reality, both more spend on information security and spending in the right places? Or are we really, is it more status quo as you look out there at what companies are doing?
Well, certainly anytime a bad event happens, there's a ring, you know, kind of a mere few that get really spooked and there's a lot of activity. I think generally we are spending more, company by company. It might range, you know, how much more, but I'm seeing budgets continue to move up, even if it's a small amount, but we are seeing percentage growth. Now, the other thing that we are seeing, and this is just the evolution of the security program maturity. There's a lot of duplicative spend. We've got multi licenses, enterprise-wide licenses for antivirus. We've got two or three SIM environments. We've got different tools that we use for data loss prevention or web application scanning. And we're seeing a lot of companies really start to take a look at their security program and do just inventory rationalization of tools. You know, I don't need 150 tools. I probably only need 10. So instead of spending for 3 enterprise-wide antivirus licenses, can you just pick one and then use that money in a more wise way that I saved from duplicative spend? So we're seeing that is a new conversation that we're having with a number of companies. I think that we are seeing moves into what things can I consume through service providers or cloud delivered capabilities that have just a different economic model, where I'm not having to build a big monolithic infrastructure. I can already use something that's ready for purpose. So even if the spend stayed the same, we're seeing people find new ways to create space within the budget that they have so that they can get more effective on those things that can actually make a difference. There are so many foundational things that we could look at that are going to really move the needle from a protection perspective. So for example, while I love some advanced elliptical encryption, what I really need is a good asset inventory. I need to know, because it's sprawling, I need to get a better sense of what systems I have, where my data actually is, and how do I start getting my arms around that. We need to look at things like, when I'm testing my environment, am I pressure testing this environment at the same veracity as the attackers are? I mean, our clients and these companies, they're on the front line, and are they testing their environment with the same strength and overwhelming technology that the attackers are using, or mm-hmm. are they just kind of walking through for a checkbox? Are they driving innovation to get better, continuous improvement? And if you can do some of these basics really, really well, that spend, you can actually reduce your spend, because again, complexity is an enemy of good security. So if I can make it more simple, I can save a little money, take that money that I freed up on things that actually make a difference, advanced identity, using machine learning and automation to really make it better. As much as we see the headlines, this is a solvable problem. And I actually think that ironically, we actually have the upper hand. We know what's important to our businesses. We know what applications we have. We know where our data is that we're supposed to be, and we can work to do that. The attackers, they have to figure all that out. And if we really focus on these basics and focus the spend on things that actually matter, we can actually get a head start. We can get an advantage over that threat landscape. So it's not despair, as much as we see the headlines, that we can actually be out ahead of this, where we can manage it a lot better.
Kevin, thanks so much for coming on Security Ledger Podcast.
Appreciate it.
And finally, the past year has brought news about major data breaches involving hundreds of millions of consumer records, but it has also brought news of some major law enforcement crackdowns on underground cyber marketplaces like Alphabay, where criminals trade stolen data. The result has been a scrambling of what some refer to as the deep dark web, a murky world of underground bazaars that are invisible to Google and other search engines, where cyber criminals ply their wares. In our final segment, we speak with Olivia Rowley, a cybercrime analyst at the firm Flashpoint, about what's bubbling on the deep dark web and efforts by some cybercriminals to find a new way to buy and sell illicit goods online.
Yeah, hi, I'm Olivia Rowley, and I'm a cybercrime analyst at Flashpoint. So the deep and dark web are these parts of the internet that are unindexed by a lot of the major search engines, and they're where a lot of this kind of shadier cyber criminal activity occurs, because they're more difficult to monitor. So that's what we specialize in here at Flashpoint, looking at I look at these cyber criminal conversations and what is being traded by cyber criminals, what it's being used for, who they're targeting. So that's what we mean by the deep and dark web.
Cyber criminal activity, obviously not the only thing that happens in this sort of unindexed off of the search engine map part of the internet, but it is a part of what's there.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of other activity that takes place there. We have a team that looks at jihadi threats, active in those spaces. Insider threats is another thing that's a lot of people are talking about now. There's all sorts of activity.
And when we're talking about these cyber criminal marketplaces on the dark web, what are they? Are they just websites, kind of traditional e-commerce type portal, just not indexed and visible to Google and the other search engines?
That's currently what most of the marketplaces look like. You know, you go there, they have a list of all the different products that you can filter by. So you can, if you're more interested in malware, you can filter out by malware. If you're more interested in, you know, stolen data, you can filter by stolen data. You can search for different keywords. So it definitely is like a traditional e-commerce platform. That being said, there's been so much instability in the darknet marketplaces following the takedowns of Alphabay and Hanza by law enforcement back in June and July, that there's a lot of chatter among cyber criminals about how the marketplace platform might change to become a better or, you know, an easier place for cyber criminals to operate.
Less easy to target, more distributed or more secure, or what are their concerns?
A whole bunch of different concerns, but you hit on a lot of them. Definitely the decentralized marketplaces is a big thing that they're talking about right now. There's been talk of decentralized marketplaces in the past. They've tended to fail due to lack of moderation and having that centralized, authority, I suppose. But that's something that there's definitely a push for, a greater push for more privacy. A lot of cyber criminals are expressing interest in Monero, which is a cryptocurrency that's with privacy in mind. So those are some of the conversations and concerns that these cyber criminals have.
And you guys, Flashpoint, yourself included, took a look at some of the data that's for sale on these dark web marketplaces. Tell us, if you could, what types of data, stolen data generally, do you find for sale there?
Well, there's really all sorts of data that's for sale. One of the main things that we took a look at in this report was looking at fulls, which are it's cyber criminal slang for a full package of personally identifiable information, which includes your social security number, your date of birth, and your full name. So with that information, all sorts of fraud can be committed. But there's also tons and tons of other information that we see out there. We see people's bank accounts, people's credit card information, and that's some of the other stuff that we covered in this report as well.
One of the things you guys observed is that there's a tremendous amount of stolen data out there kind of floating around as a result of these huge breaches that we've been reading about, and that the availability of it seems to affect the prices. In other words, you're seeing evidence of either a lot of sensitive data being sold for not that much money, or individual, you know, packages of data that where the value of the stolen data doesn't seem to align with the price that's being offered for.
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen all the different media reporting this year and in years past about these massive data breaches. And that information in many cases is ending up in the deep and dark web. Even a lot of data breaches that aren't reported on in the media, you know, smaller scale ones that might only affect a couple hundred people or a couple thousand people, that information is ending up there, which is leading to a ton and ton of information, a ton and ton of these fulls in the deep and dark web. One thing to note about that as to why the pricing is so low, obviously this tremendous amount of information out there. If you're a buyer, you've got a lot of options. You can look for the cheapest price. But additionally, from the perspective of the cyber criminal that obtained all this information, it's not easy to defraud thousands and thousands of people. So in many cases, these cyber criminals may not even be looking to use this information to commit fraud themselves, because they have so much of it. That's not their interest, which is why they just want to sell it for as cheaply as possible.
So, I mean, in addition to stolen data, there are also basically attack tools for rent, usually on these sites. You talk about exploit kits, which, you know, you can use to compromise a computer or a network, as well as denial of service for hire, DDoS for hire. Infrastructure as well. What did you see? What trends did you see, or what activity did you see around those offerings? how big of a market is, say, DDoS for hire relative to some of the other stuff, you know, stolen data on these marketplaces?
Yeah, that's a great question. The attack tools, when we looked at them, we actually weren't primarily focusing on the marketplaces because these tend to not end up on the marketplaces as frequently. And that's partially because they are often for rent. The exploit kits that we looked at for this report were being sold typically on Russian language marketplaces. And that's because Russian speaking cyber criminals tend to produce more exploit kits. Whereas the DDoS for hire was mostly on the English language marketplaces. We also, did some cursory research looking at phishing kits, bulletproof hosting, other stuff like that that's done on a rental basis. But if it's on a rental basis, it tends to not be sold on the marketplaces. It tends to be sold more often on the cyber criminal forums.
Right. So those would be kind of message boards rather than formal marketplaces where criminals would kind of like Craigslist buy and sell different services that they might need.
Precisely.
Was there anything that really jumped out and surprised you about this data that you guys gathered? I noted the stuff on RDP, remote desktop protocol, credentials. That's been a big source of compromises. And other malicious activity. It looks like you guys saw a real spike in that and then a pretty steep drop off. Any sense what was behind that spike? Did that correlate with a particular vulnerability or just what would account for that?
Yeah, we're not positive what was behind that spike, which took place in July of 2017. A hypothesis could be that with the major marketplaces of Alphabay and Hamza being down, people started to explore kind of more DIY cybercrime, and looking to buy these RDPs and use these RDPs mm-hmm. because they no longer had easy access to, you know, just buying treasure troves of data from a vendor on Alphabay. That's a hypothesis.
Do those types of activities, law enforcement activities, enforcement activities, work, as far as you can tell, in stemming the actual cyber crime, or does it just kind of push the activity elsewhere?
That's a great question. In terms of volume of sales, this is not something that we have visibility into. But one thing that the law enforcement takedowns has done is they have severely disrupted the cyber criminal ecosystem and landscape and the way that people are buying and selling. Even in this aftermath, a lot of cyber criminals are wary of certain marketplaces and are trying to avoid them because there's kind of this paranoia that everything might be compromised. There's even within the marketplaces that do exist a tremendous amount of instability where some of them are getting DDoS. Some of them are, you know, the admins are exit scamming and closing the market, taking all the money. Other ones are rebranding and changing their name and changing their URLs. So one thing it definitely has been successful in doing is severely disrupting and destabilizing the marketplaces.
Okay, so this was kind of data that was culled from a number of the ones that are active right now?
Correct. Though and we then, also,
yep.
for different parts of it, sorry.
Go ahead.
We also looked into, like I said, that we did look into Russian language forms for the exploit kits, English language forms for the DDoS for hire type stuff. And then also for card data, we looked at the major card shops that are out there, and the RDP information comes from the major RDP shops. So while we focused on the marketplaces, you know, styled like Hamza and Alphabay, for some of this research, other parts of the research, we're looking at shops catering towards that particular product.
We talked to a researcher at the University of Eindhoven, Luca Lodi, I think it was last week or the week before, about some of the research he'd done specifically on Russian cybercrime marketplaces. Some of what he said is pretty similar to what you're saying, that you know, trust was a major factor in whether or not marketplaces survived and thrived, and that the ones that he observed that that were healthy and vibrant cyber criminal marketplaces had a very strong kind of central authority who enforced contracts and punished, you know, bad actors and kind of kept the market clean and reliable. Did you see that as well? And
That's definitely something that's a lot more common on the Russian language side. And that could be partially because they don't have these more traditional marketplaces where people can leave feedback and, you know, in a very organized way. So definitely having that strong central authority is very important on the Russian language side. At times, we've actually seen the contrary on the English language marketplace side.
So it's more of like a Yelp approach on the English language sides where people, you know, customers review you and that's how you get quality.
That definitely occurs on the Russian language side as well. So I don't want to completely erase that, but I think it's a lot more important in that ecosystem. I think in the English language side of it, there's actually even at times the opposite. There are some marketplaces in which some of the admins are known to be scammers, you know, people who they take a cyber criminal client's money and then don't deliver them the goods. I think that's part of the reason why there is such instability right now is a lot of people do not trust the people running these marketplaces.
Olivia Rowley of Flashpoint, thank you so much for coming on and speaking with the Security Ledger podcast. It's been great speaking with you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Paul, and thank you for having me.